on the prophets. So they come down to Jerusalem, and we have the Jerusalem conference with the apostles and the elders, and they come to the conclusion they do not need to keep the law or be circumcised, but they need to keep these four things that aren't pertaining to the law, which was no idols, no fornication, don't eat anything strangled, and don't eat the blood. Those two are connected. Good. Then you have, at the end of 15, we're going to have 16, the beginning of the second journey. Paul and Barnabas split. They don't slit anything. They split. Barnabas and John Mark go to Cyprus, and then Paul goes off with Silas. Good. We pick up Timothy. We pick up Luke. We go through that whole process. Acts chapter 17. What are the three primary cities? Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. That's right. Then we have Acts chapter 18. In the same chapter, we have the end of the second journey and the beginning of the third journey. Good. And then in Acts 19, only one city to remember. Ephesus. We have the riots. We have the sons of Sceva. We have the burning of the books. All those things that took place in Ephesus. Then we have Acts chapter 20. What happens in Acts chapter 20? Because he leaves Ephesus. He's making his way back down Jerusalem. We're going... That's right. The first day of the week, they break bread. That's verse 7. And then we have, he meets with the Ephesian elders in what city? Miletus. That's correct. And so, Acts 21, the beginning of Acts 21 is the end of the third journey. But then the rest of Acts 21 is Paul's arrest. Good. That's when the Jews falsely accuse him. They start to beat him. Claudius Lysias comes in, arrests him. Acts 22 is going to be Paul's defense, and that's in front of the whole crowd. Acts 23, we're going to have the second defense and a plot that fails. Remember, the same plot. They're going to try to kill Paul, take his life. It's found out. Paul's nephew, that's what you guys were thinking of with Barnabas and John Mark. Paul's nephew tells Claudius Lysias. He goes up to what governor? Acts 24. Felix. And remember, FFA. 24 is Felix. 25 is Festus. 26 is Agrippa. Good. And right in the middle is where Paul makes his appeal to Caesar. That brings us to Acts chapter 27. And Acts 27 is going to be storm and shipwreck, however you want to memorize it. Just remember, Paul is on a boat this whole chapter. And this is going to be his journey, as since he has appealed to Caesar, they've got to put him on a boat. And you're actually going to see that the way that the Romans did it is there was not really a direct transport all the way to Rome from where they were, from Caesarea. That would have been kind of like when you are on a flight, if you're going a long way like I did. I didn't fly directly to Florida. I stopped in Denver, get on a different plane, then you finish your trip. We're going to see that that's what happens is the Romans set this up this way, where you would just make different connections on your way towards Rome. So, oh, that's not on. That would help. All right. This is going to be our journey. All we have up here today is maps. We're going to have a close-up of Crete, and then later on we're going to have a close-up of Malta. But let's go ahead and just read the text for now, and let's start in verse 1 of Acts 27. It says, "When it was decided that we should sail for Italy." Stop. What do you notice right away? What's different? Luke is with him, because now we have, again, the we section. And this is going to develop the largest we section, which is a paradox, of the book of Acts. And that's going to go from 27 all the way to the end of chapter 28. It appears that Paul was allowed to have different companions come with him. But what's interesting is most scholars, how we understand the way that the Roman judicial system worked, when you would appeal to Caesar, if you were a Roman citizen, you were actually allowed to bring with you two or three slaves. So when it says that Luke went with him, as we're about to read, Aristarchus goes with him, later on, Paul's going to write about Aristarchus in Colossians, that he is my fellow prisoner. What we don't understand is Luke likely went with Paul under the name of Paul's slave. And that's how Luke was able to go with Paul and minister to him. That's not how Paul would have treated Luke. That's not how Paul would have treated Aristarchus. But that's likely what's happening here, and that's likely how Luke was able to go with him on this judicial transport all the way up to Rome. So, Luke is with him, and this chapter is so exciting. This is going to read just like a novel. And so we start, they set sail for Italy, and they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. Now remember, how many people is a centurion over in a Roman legion? It's 100, and there's 10 centurions that make up each legion. And so at least who's going to be on this boat, we don't know if it's the full number of soldiers, but it could be up to as many as 100 soldiers that are making sure Paul is going to get safe transport to the best of their abilities all the way up to Rome. And we're going to see at the end of this chapter, there were 276 persons that were going to be on this boat when they make their transition. All right, verse 2. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. Now, again, we don't know if he volunteers to go with Paul. It's also possible that he was arrested for some other reason in Judea, and so he's being sent up as a prisoner to fight in the Colosseum as a gladiator. We don't know why Aristarchus is with him, whether he's a slave or whether he's actually a prisoner. But Paul is going to have at least two companions with him on this whole trip, with Luke and Aristarchus. And the next day, we put in at Sidon. And so they're going to come all the way up here. They start in Caesarea, and you're going to go about 35 miles up to Sidon. And this is where they're going to make port. And as we're going to see, they're going to sail all the way around the Cape of Cyprus here until they get to Asia Minor, and they're going to stop in Myra. And so he says, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Now, why would Julius allow Paul to get off the boat as a prisoner and walk around the city and go meet up with people? Because remember, if you lost your prisoner, what happened under Roman law if they escaped? You would be executed personally yourself. So it's possible a soldier would have been chained to Paul as he goes, but he gives Paul this freedom. Why would he let Paul have this kind of freedom? Okay, one, he's a Roman citizen. But let's think about this more. Remember, Festus is in a peculiar predicament. Why did he call this council together and ask for King Agrippa's help? He had examined Paul, and there's nothing Paul has done. There is no Roman law condemning Paul. He is an innocent man. And the only reason he is going to Caesar is because by law, when he appealed, he has to go up. And so Paul is going to be given some more provisions than any of the other prisoners, because to the Romans, this is an innocent man. He has no reason to get up and leave if he were to go off to Sidon, because it was Paul himself that appealed to Caesar, even though he knew he could go free. So Julius has some wisdom here. He recognizes, I can trust Paul. Paul's not going to go anywhere. Now, when it says friends, we don't have any record in Acts of a church in Sidon, but we know that this whole region was evangelized in the diaspora when they went away from Jerusalem. So that's likely who we're talking about. And it's interesting, the word cared for normally implies a sickness, that someone was sick. And that's how usually that term is used. And it's interesting that Luke would use that term, because what was Luke's profession? He's a doctor. Now, let's just think logically here. Why would Paul have to be cared for? What would Paul be sick for? Let's just think about boats. Okay. Boats were not what we have today, right? And we're going to see in this narrative that the wind is going to be battling them the entire time. And if the wind is coming in from the west, it's blowing east or northeast, as we're going to see, and they're trying to travel this direction, you're going to have a crosswind that's going to end up rocking you the entire time. And so this is going to be a bad journey for everyone, and this is how it starts off. As Paul, only after 35 miles, has to get off because he's sick, and he's got to be cared for. Yeah, Brad. That's possible. That would certainly be true in the case of clothing or with health. In the case of food, we're going to see that later on in this chapter, they had a galley that would be equally divided up amongst the crew. And Paul and Luke are going to have their hand in that. But that's going to be on the second boat. That was a transport boat up to Italy that was taking wheat from Africa. So it's possible that this boat, maybe he did have to provide for his own provisions. But in the second boat, we know that that's not the case. But that's a good question. So that's very much absolutely a possibility as we read the text. All right. So he's cared for, verse 4. And putting out from sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. So they're going to try to come up and allow the island to block them from the wind so that way they can move without being pushed back the other direction. But here's what's interesting. If the wind is blowing from the northwest and you're trying to go this direction, did they have motorized, you know, engines back then to move their boats? We're going to see this is going to be a very slow journey. These ships would probably be moving at 3, 4, maybe 5 miles an hour. Because when they're loaded down with the wind, the fastest they would move is about 12 miles an hour from what we understand from ancient Near Eastern nautical references about these kinds of boats. And so this is a very slow process all the way up around the Cape until they get to Myra. And so it says, and when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. And here's our connecting flight, so to speak. Verse 6. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We're going to see later on in this chapter, Alexandria is down here, okay, in Egypt. And so it had also taken this same journey, probably the same journey they had done, and had come into port at Myra, and it's going to be carrying a whole bunch of wheat and grain. And it's going to take this up to Italy. Now, this is how ships worked back then. You would have a captain and an owner of the ship. And the owner of the ship was not only the owner of the ship, he was also the owner of all of the cargo of the ship. And what would happen is he would buy at his own expense everything that he's getting from, like, Alexandria. And then, once he got to Italy, he would sell all of it, and that's where he would make his profit. But the owner was in charge of financially what was taking place, and the captain was the one who would have run the crew and run the ship. He was most familiar with how to sail. Those were going to be the two guys that make most of the decisions. And that's important as we read this narrative and we understand what's going to happen. So verse 7, we sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. And coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Haven, which was near the city of Lacia. So here's what's happening. This was their first possible route, is they come from Myra and they're trying to get just about 130 miles between the island of Rhodes and up here to the tip of Lycia, which is Cnidus. And they said they sailed with great difficulty. Again, we're going to see in this narrative, the winds are coming from the northwest. That's what's been happening. So if you got winds blowing directly opposite of where you want to go, and you're traveling at about maybe 2 miles an hour, how long is it going to take for you to go 130 miles? You know, and you're not going to go in a straight direction. The winds are going to blow you here and there. This trip to go 130 miles might have taken up to 2 weeks. This was a long, tedious journey. And so sometimes we think, you know, well, why didn't people just, you know, when Paul was doing his missionary journeys, why did he travel by land? Why wouldn't he have just sailed all over the place like he did towards the end of his journeys? Well, because you had no promise that traveling by water was any faster than it would have been traveling by land. In fact, if you had horseback or camelback or whatever, most of the time it was actually faster to travel by land than it was by water, if you had the winds against you. If you had the winds for you, no sweat. And we're going to see that later on. So they're attempting to come up here to the Cape, right off Achaia, and hopefully ride this all the way down until they can follow Macedonia up here, go around the boot, around Sicily, and hopefully get to Rome. But the wind is so strong, they can't even make it another 160 miles here, actually 260 miles, excuse me, this distance. So they say, you know what, we're going to sail south. That's opposite of where we need to go. But in doing so, they would have the winds with them, and they could quickly come here down to Crete, and as soon as they turn this corner, what would they again be sheltered from? The wind. So this is their thinking. We can quickly come down here, be sheltered from the wind, we're going to make port, and then wait for the winds to change, and then we'll quickly be able to come back up. That's their plan. And this is what they're thinking about doing as far as sailing goes. So, verse 9, they put in here at Fair Havens, which had the port open to the east, actually. And let me go here. The port would have been open, actually, towards the east, but it would have not been a great shelter from the wind. It still allowed the sea to come up and beat on your ships. And what we're going to see is this trip has taken enough time that they understand they're not going to be able to make it up here and to port before the winter. They understand that they're going to have to stay on this island for the entire winter. Now, what they're going to have to decide, we're going to see, is Fair Havens was a very small port, and the closest city was a two-hour walk away, and it was a smaller city, Lycia. Now, if you have 276 people on board, is that going to be a burden on a small city for an entire winter to take care of that many people? I mean, absolutely. So there's going to be a discussion, and what they're going to decide against Paul's advice is they're going to say, we're going to wait for the winds to change, we're going to wait for a south wind, and we're just going to go 35 miles that'll only take us maybe 4 hours. And we're going to try to make it all the way up here to Phoenix, and that's where we're going to stay for the winter. And that's a much better place to stay. There would have been more provisions. It would have been the best option. Excuse me. But here's what happens. Verse 9. Since much time had passed, the voyage was now very dangerous because even the fast was already over. And when it says the fast was already over, what's that? Oh, sorry, I thought I heard someone. This is talking about the Day of Atonement, and this happened on the 10th day of the month of the month of Tishri, and that's normally about October in the way that we understand. And so Paul's saying that we're getting to the point where you can't sail anymore in these waters. It was considered suicide, and Josephus and even Caesar in some of his writings talk about how no one sailed between these months within the Mediterranean because it was a death wish. In fact, Josephus is going to be on a ship with 600 people 2 years later in 63 AD that's going to be shipwrecked because they sailed at a time they should not have sailed. So Paul is going to argue, guys, we can't even make it this 35 miles. We just need to stay here in this harbor. And this is what he says. Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo of the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than what Paul has said. Now, does that surprise anyone? Okay, Paul is not necessarily, he's a prisoner. He has some special liberties. They don't consider him guilty. But he has no idea of Paul's sailing experience or whatever. That'd be like if you're in a plane and there's the owner of the plane and the pilot of the plane, and they say, we're going to go ahead and try to make this flight. We think we can make it. And one of the passengers says, don't do it. We're all going to die. You know, you're going to trust the pilot and the owner of the plane because they have the experience. They know what they're doing. Well, we're going to see that Paul's words are going to come back to bite them. Verse 12, and because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that they could somehow reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So they're going to try to make it all the way up to this harbor. And as it appears, Lady Luck shows up to start. Verse 13. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. When it says that they had assumed that they had already obtained their purpose, what's another way of saying that? Yeah, we're as good as there. We got the south wind. We're going to just shoot up. We're going to be there in just a couple hours. Sit back, relax, enjoy your flight, right? And so that's what they are thinking. But before they could even travel up this coast of Crete in 4 hours, look at what happens in verse 14. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster. And that's interesting because that word is a mix of Greek and Latin, that word that's used there, called the Northeastern. The Greek word is euros, which is east wind, and Latin is aquilo, euro aquilo, and that's a north wind. It'd be like when we mix English and Spanish, if you're saying I'm doing very bueno or something like that. Sorry, Mariano. You know, that's what they do here. They mix Latin and Greek. And that's just used, it's a nautical term that was used to describe, they named the winds and what directions they came from. So they're trying to go up here, and all of a sudden, a northwest tempestuous wind is coming down off of the mountains in Crete, which are at about 7,000 feet elevation, and they are just really blowing that ship to the point where they can't make this journey. And they're going to be pushed all the way down over here to this island, Claudia, and they are a long ways off. Now they're in trouble. Winter is here. The wind is pushing them the opposite direction. If they're not careful, it's going to push them all the way south to the point where they shipwreck close to Africa. Okay? So, they say, running under, or it says, verse 15, and when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and we were driven along. And running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, and that's what we have here. Sometimes the spelling has an L there. We managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. And here's what they meant there. You guys want to see my artwork? This is going to be great. All right. Is this side empty? Good. All right. Don't judge me, but we're going to draw first century boats here. And how they operated. Because normally when we think people sailing on the ocean, what movies jump right into your mind when you think boats? Like Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, like we think this grand ship with all these sails. Here's how the boats worked. And this is the boat. Everyone say, good job, BJ. All right, so, and they would have one tall mast with a sail. That was their main sail for traveling. And then on the front of the boat, which often had Greek gods depicted on the front, you would have another sail, and this was primarily used for steering. And they would have as many as 8 different oars. This ship we're going to see is going to have 2, one on each side, that would also be help for steering. And they would have as many as 8 different anchors. Most of them would go off the bow, but this one's going to come off the stern. But instead of the big ships that we see that would have little other boats attached to the side, how they did it is they would have a rope attached to the back, and this other ship would be towed along as they are traveling. And this would be used to ferry people back in and out from an island or whatever they needed to do. All right? Is that a good picture? Yes. All right. Anyway, that is how their boats worked. And so when it says that we had difficulty securing the ship's boat, think about this for a moment. You've got this boat being tugged behind, and the water is being blown everywhere and huge waves. Have you ever tried to pull something up that's filled with water? This boat is now starting to sink behind them. And Luke is saying, with difficulty, we barely were able to get this boat up out of the water and bring it onto the bow and secure this ship. We almost lost our boat. Okay? So they're in a bad place. Verse 16. And running under the lee of a small island called Cotta, we managed to, with difficulty, secure the ship's boat. And after hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. And this is an idea of giving the ship a belt. And they would literally, to secure the mast and to secure the ship, they would put these belts around the boat. And what it would do is it would focus the attention mostly on one spot and secure it, because as the waves are beating on a boat, what would happen is these boats would start to break up in different places and you would start to leak. That's a bad thing when you're trying to sail somewhere. You don't want that to happen. So they are trying to do everything they can because they understand at this point that they have to prepare for a shipwreck. They don't want to. They don't want to sink, but they're taking every precautionary measure they can. Verse 17, and then fearing that the wind would run them on the Syrtis, and that was a known bank that had shifted during that time, high sands, and so they're worried about running aground and your ship would be wrecked with all your cargo. What they did is they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. And there's some debate about that, but what it seems they did is they removed the mast. And they put this whole thing down, so that way the only sail that they had left was one just to steer them in the direction that they wanted to go. They're doing everything they can to not be further driven. Verse 18, and since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. Now, if you're the owner of the ship, is this something you want to do? Because you're losing all your money. But why would you start to throw things overboard? Okay, but what's the... I understand survive. Okay, when you lighten it, the boat's riding into the waves. It's low and it's heavy. And it's going to take more of a beating. It's going to break the ship apart faster. But when you lighten the load, the ship is more likely to ride on top of the waves, and it's not going to get as much of a beating that way. And hopefully you might be able to spare the ship what little cargo you have left and everyone else's lives. Y'all didn't know you were getting a nautical lesson today, but I didn't know any of this hardly before studying for this week. Verse 18, they were jettisoning the cargo. Verse 19, and on the third day, now the days are going to get longer, but I want you to imagine this. I mean, we've all seen those movies where there's a big storm and you can't see the sun during the day, you can't see the stars at night. One, is that a problem for sailors back then? That's the only way they had direction. They knew where they were. And you can just imagine getting no rest and having no time to eat because the storm doesn't let up. For 3 days in a row, and we're going to actually see this is going to happen for 14 days in a row, where they are just continually hammered and hammered, and the boat is breaking apart more, and they're trying to get water out of the boat, and no one is getting to sleep, and no one is getting to eat, and people are going to start to lose hope. And it says, and on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. A lot of debate about what that is. It appears anything that was unnecessary. Utensils, anything else, personal belongings, everything else was thrown overboard to lighten the load more. Verse 20, and when neither the sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us. In other words, this is a big storm, and they had no idea where they were. All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. And since they had been without food for a long time, now that word translated is actually loss of appetite. We're going to see later on in this text, they had plenty of food on board. It's not that they were starving because there was no food. They were not eating because they couldn't eat. They had no time or ability to eat because of how bad the storm was. You can imagine yourself in a car accident, a car wreck. Are you going to be worried about eating your sandwich while you're flipping in the car? You know, that's the kind of stress level they're under. They can't even have time to eat. Yeah, Brad.
Mm-hmm. Coincidence or providence that this has happened?
We don't know. Yeah.
As Paul said that he perceived, did he actually see a vision that this was going to be happening?
Mm-hmm.
If it continued?
Mm-hmm.
And is it God's providence to make sure things happen? He's still going to spare lives, but to make sure Paul gets certain things done.
That's right. And so it's of my opinion, and this is just my opinion, that the first time Paul spoke up was Paul's opinion. But Paul's about to speak up again, and he is not only going to say, you need to listen to me now, because one, if you had, now he has some clout, you should have listened to me because look where we are. One, I was right. And now two, if you listen to me, it's because this is what the Lord says, not Paul. So Paul's going to speak up. And Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and have not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. Oh, really, Paul? We're all in the position they're in, they think we're all going to die. And Paul says, not a single one of you is going to die. And this is why. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you and all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have told. But we must run aground on some island. This is what Paul says. And there's a lesson here that we don't have time to discuss, and this is not to lift us up in any way, but when you look at the scriptures, the righteous oftentimes bring deliverance and reward to those that are around them. When Joseph went to Potiphar's house, what happened to Potiphar's house and all those with him? They all prospered. If there had been as many as 10 righteous men in Sodom and Gomorrah, what would God not have done? And here, 275 other lives, and I would argue 273 other lives, are going to be saved on the account of three righteous men. Paul, Aristarchus, and Luke, but particularly Paul. But Paul says, we have to run aground on some island. Verse 27, when the 14th night had come, 2 weeks of this continual beating. And imagine, this is where they had started. They tried to set sail from here. They have traveled 600 miles in 2 weeks, being driven by the wind and beaten by the storm. And where we're about to pick up is they're going to be right here. They have no idea where they are. But it says, we are being driven across the Adriatic Sea, and that's the middle of the Mediterranean. what is called the Adriatic Sea today is not what was called the Adriatic Sea then. So don't get confused if you look at a current map and say, well, that's way over here. No, that's a different place. Verse 28. So they took sounding and found 20 fathoms. And a little farther, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. Now, some other texts discuss them hearing the breaking of the waves. So when you think about it, a fathom was about, what they would do is they would take the rope and they would measure it out an entire arm's length, about 6 feet. And they would measure that out, and so they're at 20 fathoms, and then about a half an hour later, they measure again and they're at 15 fathoms. So if you hear waves breaking and you are getting shallower and shallower, that means you're really close to land of some kind. But the problem is, if you're hearing things, waves breaking, what does that mean you're likely coming up really quickly on? Rocks. And a reef. You could end up really getting in a really bad situation. So here's what they say. Verse 29, and fearing that we might run on the rocks, we let down four anchors. Anchors were a lot lighter then. They were iron. They would have as many as eight sometimes. They let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. We're going to try to do this when we can see what we're doing. And as the sailors were seeking to escape the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. And then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. So these sailors, they think we're going to die and this is our last chance. We're going to say we're getting down into our little boat and going up to the bow of the boat to attach anchors to make sure we stay put. But then after doing that, they might have done that. They had no intention of bringing that boat back up on board. They were going to take it right to the sound of that land, that island, and they were going to save themselves. Paul, somehow perceiving this, whether by the Holy Spirit or just because he's not a dummy, tells the centurion, so the centurion picks up his axe or a sword, whatever, and he goes by, doom, 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 cuts all those ropes away, and the boat's gone. Why would he get rid of the boat? They could use that maybe the next day to get onto the island. Why would he get rid of the boat? Okay, now they don't have a choice. Now they have to work together. They would need these men if they're going to make this plan work. They need seafaring men who know what they're doing to run this ship aground and everyone to get on the island safely. Paul knows that. And so here we have another lesson. We're out of time. But when Paul said, when the Lord promised Paul, none of you are going to die, Paul just didn't say, okay, I'll let God do all the work. He understood that they needed to do their best as well. And that's sometimes how God's providence works. And that's another lesson in and of itself. How many times the scriptures speak of someone saying, who knows whether God will do such and such? Who knows whether God will do this? That exact phrase. And so Paul is saying, who knows whether the Lord will allow this to happen? We need to make sure that we're doing our best. And so they cut the ropes, and like Cortez who burned the ships, they have no other choice. They've now got to work together. And next week, we will go ahead and wrap up this chapter. It'll go quickly. But what's going to happen is they're going to end up running aground, not being able to make it into the bay that they wanted to, on this island called Malta. And that is where they're going to get some relief, some support. Everyone survives. And then they will make their journey the rest of the way up to Italy and Rome. All right. That's it. Thank you for coming to your boat class 101 today. Thank you.